Welcome to another episode of Subscription Radio, and I'm your host today, DJ Fish, Ben Fisher, and with me, I'm really excited to introduce a good friend of mine, Matthew Barnes. Matt, extremely excited for this conversation. He is someone that we've worked with, I've worked with over the past probably like 5 or 6 months, and I've gotten to see his and his team's work firsthand, working with brands like Jot. But Matt runs, we'll call it not a full service agency. Basically, it's their agency specialists, consultants who do everything from helping with conversion rate optimization, focus specifically on D2C brands doing between 2 to 20 million. And yeah, Matt, welcome to the show. Thanks for being able to jump on before your trip to Europe.
Yeah, no, thank you for accommodating my ever asynchronous schedule.
So let's kick it off a little bit talking about, we were joking before the show that you've been doing this since like for 12 years, back when Shopify was, I don't know if you were working on the snowboard shop run by this guy named Toby. He was probably the first customer on Shopify.
So when I got into this whole thing, I was a mechanical engineer doing graduate school and started working for a small e-com brand that I thought was really interesting and, you know, kept land grabbing more and more responsibilities and eventually moved everything to this brand new platform called Shopify that seemed great, integrated everything soup to nuts from the warehouse to ads and all of that fun stuff, and ended up dropping out of graduate school for mechanical engineering to operate the company full time. And since then, I've had the pleasure of working directly on the inside of many e-commerce brands from very tiny to absolutely enormous, and then also working as a director coaching PMs on how to run successful accounts and getting to look under the hood of lots of things. And now Proteus Digital Lab, my band of heroes, we specifically are trying to work with brands that are, yes, as you put it, like in the 2 to 20 million. I like that space because I get to work with CEOs and founders a lot, which is the part that I find interesting. I think of what we do a lot as coaching kind of like CEOs on how to sell to people that don't look like them anymore. So we're probably talking a little bit more about plateaus, but the first plateau you hit is you run out of people that look exactly like you, and then you have to start selling to like your mom. And that's a fun time when people are raising money and trying to take something that has market fit and expand it to a broader audience.
Awesome. And I know that one of the things that I think from our early conversations was you're also like a Google Analytics nerd, right?
Yeah. For better or for worse. No, it's, we have lots of conversations around, hey, can we install this like analytics thing? And I was like, you know that it's just a dashboard on top of Google Analytics, right? We could just save $100,000 and probably just look at Google Analytics together. Yeah.
Well, so let's start it off around the plateaus.
Yeah.
And talking about what you see with brands going from, I think we'll start off at brands who have some sort of product. Like, at what point do you consider it product market fit? And maybe that's a charged term, especially in D2C. But yeah, what would you consider product market fit? And then like, what are those different stages that you're looking at? And what are the challenges?
It always depends, right? Because we're looking at things like AOV. I always think if you're doing approximately 1,000 orders a month, that's a pretty good product market fit, right? Like the numbers have stabilized a little bit. You're not in the game of every time you send out an email, that's when all your sales happen. You're actually acquiring new customers, that sort of thing. But typically there's kind of like a wall you hit where like all the easy ones are done. All the easy customers that are just going to sell themselves are sort of done. And oftentimes they look like the founder is super into mountain bikes and can sell to all the people that look like him to buy mountain bikes or something along those lines. And so everybody looks to the CEO and says like, okay, what do we do now? Right. And they're not qualified to answer that question, which is fine. Right. Like they got up to like that stage and now it's, well, I don't know. I don't know how to sell to my mom. I don't know how to sell to my cousin. Right. That's where data comes in. Right. We use data to answer those questions. And that's when we start getting into optimization. And so helping crack open the psychology of the customer. I think, you know, once you, people have a general idea kind of like, what makes their product good. When you hit that first plateau, it's when you realize you don't actually understand all of your customers anymore. And I think that that's a meaningful turning point in sort of growth.
Got it. And so typically, and up until that point, do you find that people are typically doing all it's performance advertising in-house? Are they working with a third-party agency? maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's a slew of those.
It kind of depends on what the core competencies of like the founding team are. A lot of times they're still doing stuff in-house and experimenting with different ads and things like that. At the point that we typically engage, it's usually around the time that you're starting to like outsource different stuff, or the rest of the team is trying to get the CEO to stop personally doing everything so they can go raise money and make hard decisions on other things. But that's where it starts getting really interesting, because usually when we first engage with somebody, the first thing that we always do is we spend about a month going through and doing an audit where we help them figure out what the hell is actually going on their website, because most people have no idea. So a great case in point, we have a brand that we worked with, and they spent a lot of time putting a lot of content on their product pages, like a lot of product story stuff. And they sell like a shampoo, body wash, conditioner, all of this fun stuff. Well, as it turns out, like after we did an audit, 50% of the customers just actually buy from the collection page, because once they understand like, oh, you don't put crap in it, it smells really good. They don't need to go to the product page to buy the conditioner with the shampoo. Like they get it, right? Like they've used the product before. And so it's really fun to do those audits, because oftentimes people are like, oh yeah, like people love our whatever content and no one ever sees it, right? And you're now, as you're starting to expand and run ads, if you're doing it right, you're not landing people on the homepage anymore. And so you now have this other new problem where all of your brand story stuff, everything that helps qualify the customer, lives on a page that isn't the product page. Now you have this like ice cold traffic just hitting a product page with dollars and an add to cart button and no other context. That's a very fun place, I guess, for us to start optimizing on. And then there are other plateaus after that.
Got it. And are there certain, like, if you were to summarize or like just talk about those plateaus from 2 to 20?
Yeah.
And maybe that's just being too broad.
Sure.
So feel free to tell me to shut up. But is it typically at certain revenue levels? Like, where are those different points? Like, what are the asymptotes?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think of it in terms of number of raw orders, because we tend to see being the meaningful, you know, differentiation. There's usually like a plateau that happens before 1,000 orders where you're really having to optimize for those ads. And that's where like product pages just become like the hotness, all the way up to maybe, you know, 1,200, 1,500 transactions like a month. Specifically when you're working with like subscriptions as well, like that's like obviously like a really meaningful point, where you have like a lot of businesses where they're maybe doing, call it 2,000 recurring orders a month, but they're only acquiring 600 new ones, right? And so they're in a high growth situation, but the actual meaningful number of interactions that are happening on that page is still like quite small, and they're trying to crack the nut on how do you move that percentage of subscriptions up higher. And so that is like a very common place for us to start. And then you kind of like hit a point there where it's like, okay, now what's like the deal, right? So beyond the product, we got to work the deal, which is how do I convince you to, you know, take this other product we sell for free, or get two of them, or engage in a more frequent subscription option and that sort of thing. And that's oftentimes will move and help people get into landing page territory, where people will spend an awful lot of time building landing pages around like getting the content just perfect. And it's the deal that is really the thing that matters. And people don't like that answer because it's not sexy, but figuring out how do I always say like you want the customer to feel dumb for taking like a one-time offer, basically, is the thing. You don't want to take it away. That's a terrible idea. Everybody thinks like, oh, what if we just take it away? We just only offer that never works ever. You definitely want the one time there to anchor it, to make them feel dumb for not taking the subscription. But that's like sort of plateau two. And that'll get you up to, you know, several thousand probably orders. And then you have this lovely thing that happens once you know, or in the several thousand orders a month stage, where you actually have to come back to your website because it now serves a different crowd. You have lots of returning folks that are now coming directly to the site, and it's no longer like your new acquisition, or it is your new acquisition for people that are like at someone's house and see the job, you know, that they poured you, and then they go and they look it up and they take. So the nature of what function different parts of your website serve changes over time as you grow. And I think that that's a really easy thing for people to like misconceptually, is that like, oh, your website's not for new customers anymore. Actually, now it's for new customers again that are coming to you through word of mouth, or now you've gotten into TV or whatever the thing is. And that's sort of like, you toggle back and forth. You start on the website, you go to landing pages, you come back to the website as you grow again.
That's really interesting. So yeah, it's that sort of like at different stages you're dealing with landing pages versus PDP. And you're even saying, like, within one example where you're not even a brand, or depends also on the theme, but a consumer might be interacting mostly with your collections pages as opposed to even like the product page. And I want to actually go back to one thing you said. It was really interesting because you were talking about how using the one-time offer as the price anchor, right? The subscription. And one question I have around that is, like, as more and more brands are offering subscriptions, and I think part of what I'll just say, like, intellectually, what's kind of funny is this idea that, and maybe you can speak to this from, we'll call it from a, you have a huge sample of brands as well as just a lot of data and experience. But, you know, if someone subscribes the very first time that they're trying your product, they're not really a subscriber. They're signing up for a discount.
Yes.
Right. They haven't tried your product before. They're not a customer. They are a customer. Maybe, I don't know if you have, if you say it's like after they renew once or if they renew twice, but yeah, I'm curious about this propensity to drive people to subscribe versus result. We've also talked about driving people to buy in bulk, right? Versus buying one time and trying to then move someone into a subscription. Like, I'm curious, have you run experiments? Like, what have you seen? And feel free to say, like, I haven't tried that, but I'm curious from a thought experiment as well as just from what you've seen.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I mean, that's the thing, is you don't want to go so aggressive that you misalign incentives, right? So, like, one of the things that we experimented with, like, early on, especially as people were trying to, like, it's amazing how much subscriptions have just, like, evolved even in the last 2 years, like, especially as a result of the pandemic, because it's like, I can't go every week to just the grocery store, right? So people, like, the aggressive thing that was, like, the hotness, like, a year and a half ago was 50% off, like, your first order if you subscribe. And what you find is that you just get a bunch of, like, crap customers, basically, because it's people that are just taking a steep discount and then just, like, hard churning. So one of the things that we do is, like, optimization isn't just, like, what are people doing on the website? It's, like, actually following that customer over time. And so we're, like, tagging people as they, like, come, as they exit the gift shop, right? In order to follow them then, and we look at that. So we may run a test for, like, a month and then follow that cohort for, like, 2 months afterwards after the test runs to see what their retention levels are like. But yeah, it's like you want to, it's like a fine balance where there are great customers who will start as, like, a one-time situation, right? Like, I'm actually, it's, I never try to use myself as a case because I'm, like, way too close to, like, all of the different permutations. But, like, I will just buy a whole bunch of stuff, like, one time and then subscribe to it because that's, like, just my habit now, knowing how all the stuff works. But, and you will have customers who are great, who just, they will not commit to a subscription until they've tried the thing. And you don't want to make it, you want to make it them feel, like, silly maybe, but, like, still, like, it'd be within, like, striking distance. And I think a 50% discount is, like, that's not the game. You're getting too many bad customers to take the subscription, and you're penalizing people who might just want to try the darn thing before they subscribe. So something that I think is more effective in that is the strategy of letting them go deeper into the product spread. So give them some nominal discount, but, like, throw in, like, another product, because then you're just giving them cogs and you're getting them deeper into, like, another category, perhaps, depending on what you sell. And that tends to go much, much better. And then to your point, like, the bulk order type thing, it's interesting because the bulk order type thing, I don't think is, like, a replacement good necessarily for, like, one time versus subscription. It's basically just it's a subscription that I buy.
It's a prepaid subscription. Yeah.
And then my subscription delivers out of my cabinet, right? So I think that some of the brands that we work with, the ones that do a really good job are for the one-time customers, giving them, like, a soft entry into, like, then subscription or bulk ordering or whatever the thing is. You can always withhold the candy and then give the candy again later, right? So you can let them come in as a one-time and then in the email go, hey, that subscription offer that you passed up, we'd actually still love to offer you that, right? You can still have the free gift or whatever the thing is. So you still get them into, like, the deeper cycle, but you give them an opportunity without, like, them feeling like they're penalized. Nobody wants to feel penalized as a consumer. Incentivized, yes. Penalized, no.
Got it. So I'm curious. So in that case, are you saying that if someone were to buy one time, you would then effectively send a post-purchase email that offers them to convert that purchase into a subscription, or that you still just offer them a gift?
Even their next order, right? Like, let's say they purchased as a one-time and you send them an email and you say, hey,
got it,
purchase your next order as a subscription. We'll still give you the gift. We're sure you're going to love it.
Got it. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
And this is the thing, is that that when people say like, oh, like, what do you look for in like a subscription like product? Like flexibility to do stuff like that, I think is really what I'm looking for, because I think too many people treat a conversion as just like an event. Like it's just the thing, right? That, oh, we want the conversion to be higher. Now you want like the whole experience to be, they don't have an experience if they don't buy anything, but you have to think about like the holistic like life cycle of the customer, because it's too easy to optimize for terrible customers in the name of the number was bigger in this variant than that variant. And you don't think about like the lifetime value or long-term like quality of that customer. I've seen lots of people run businesses where they're like, oh, we're going to develop this very inexpensive product as like people's like gateway into it. And what they actually do is they create two businesses inside the business. They just sell the cheap, small product to a subset of terrible customers and then scale all their ad spend on it. And they never cross over to the more expensive products.
Interesting.
Right? I know. Lots of well-intended things that look like a success in the short term that actually like cripple a business in the long term because people don't think long term.
I'm curious with, so going back to like consumer behavior and like the offers, I'm just going to like throw out a bunch of different things that some brands do and some brands don't that I've just heard. Like some people just do and will not do it. And feel free to pick on any of these things or just tell me none of these topics you have a point of view on.
I have a point of view on every topic. You're in luck. Okay, go on.
So a couple of things, and I'll call this as like a macro trend that's already happened that we were talking about, is more and more brands are offering subscriptions, right? Like the latest stat was like SUPTA, which is like the trade organization. I don't know if they're a real trade organization or a fake. Doesn't matter.
Depends on who you ask.
The subscription trade organization. Like the stat was like 73% of D2C brands will offer some sort of subscription by 2023. And so I'm curious about what will be changing around consumer behavior. So I think, for example, if we are pushing, and we're already seeing this, like if everyone's offering a subscription, kind of like if everyone's asking you to get married, and granted at a certain point, like consumers know that they can figure out a way to cancel the subscription. But I'm just curious, do you expect to see challenges around driving to a subscription on the initial purchase if it's like, well, this is just something else I'm going to have to do? Or do you think that won't impact conversion?
The short answer is it depends, and I do have a strong opinion about this. So
okay,
most of the people driving subscriptions for their products, it's totally driven by VC money because they say, hey, the way to have a sustainable business to protect my investment is for you to have a subscription-based thing, and I will give you two fake internet points for every one fake internet point if you have subscriptions instead of not subscriptions, and it's a way easier way to raise money. Now, as everybody who has ever raised money as an e-commerce brand knows, you are often incentivized to do things that are incredibly stupid. So adding subscription for the sake of subscription is not inherently a great, and like consumers on one hand are like very like casual. Like my favorite thing is watching screen recordings of people using websites. It's a very eye-opening thing for somebody who's like in love with their brand. I always say it's like you prepared this like beautiful Thanksgiving dinner and then a bunch of dogs just come and eat it. That's like what it's like watching your customers like use your website. But for products where subscription is actually convenient and actually makes sense, that will just remain durable, like dog food. Do I want to go buy dog food? No, I don't want to buy dog food. My dog's just going to keep eating the same food, right? So like subscription is a terrific idea for dog food. T-shirts. I don't need a t-shirt subscription. I will just have t-shirts and I will wear them. And when they wear out or I get tired of them and give them to the charity shop, I will buy a new t-shirt. I don't need a subscription for t-shirts to remind me to buy t-shirts. That is incredibly stupid, right? But if you can get people to take subscriptions on t-shirts, your valuation, your company goes up and you get more favorable VC terms and whatever. So everybody's going to try subscriptions. And then eventually that's just going to like, you're just going to see like a long tail on that, like not working out for brands where it's totally inappropriate. And then VCs will stop asking for it. And then people will do it like a little bit less. But for like actual products that make sense on a subscription, I think that trend is just, that's going to keep happening. Because especially since like recharge is no longer the only option, which like I have so many sour words about recharge, but now that Shopify offers like through their API, like actual subscription capabilities, like recharge is like the blocker to like most companies like offering a subscription product because it's just an enormous pain and then screws all your analytics to incorporate it. So like the cost of entering into it's too high. So I I've had a lot of businesses approach us recently that are in like the subscription realm of things and are very excited about it and are expanding their offering of things because of all the capabilities that exist now. And I think it's a really great thing, especially it's a good utilization of like SMS and things like that as well, because like actually being notified that a thing's going to happen and allow me to take action to either like delay it or increase the amount that I get or something like that in a convenient way is great. Like most SMS stuff is totally going to be, it's SMS is just new email. Like everyone's like very excited about that as a channel because it like works. It just works because people are fatigued on email. And now, right, like the number of people that are just like, I did not tell this brand that they could just like text me or whatever. This is stupid. I hate it. Right. Like you'll tolerate a couple of those and then you're never doing SMS like again. But I think again, for subscription, it's like the right tool for the job. So subscriptions on t-shirts, not going to make it. Subscriptions on dog food, great. SMS random things like, hey, we just have new sunglasses, not going to make it. SMS on, hey, are you ready for us to ship your next order? That's going to be great. It's just consumer fatigue will eventually just catch up with this crap.
Yeah, no, and that's interesting. And I think, you know, one thing that we've seen and we've even experimented, like an early version, we haven't actually talked about our business rodeo on the podcast, actually, I think ever, in part because the purpose of this is nerding out on subscriptions. But I will say, like, one of our first products was SMS, basically being able to buy with a reply. So this is actually, this was before PostScript. It was an early version of our replenishment product that we built called One Click Pony. And so it's just funny. But what I was going to say was we, at the time, built out exactly functionally what you see with Recharge SMS and PostScript, where you can reply and it will ask you messages. And I think what I'm curious in, and you and I have worked together, so you know the way that, at least with Rodeo, the way we approach it, which is we approach it with a link as opposed to the robot menu.
Yes.
And, you know, I am curious to what extent you think that's the right move. I can say as a consumer, I think at a certain point, like this idea, kind of like almost when you call an operator and she says, push one to do this, push three to do this. And it's different if it's visual than if you're just having to listen to all the options. But one of the issues with that is that it really just makes it, I mean, it makes it convenient to reorder, which I really like, but yeah. You as a brand don't have control over the user experience.
That's right.
And you make it super easy to cancel, and it should be easy to cancel, but you as a brand should be able to sort of control the experience in a way that it's not like push one.
Yeah, because there are other options other than canceling. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, like the work when you and I, like obviously the way that the Rodeo works, where we have the link that, a magic link that goes into the portal. And then the whole point of that is once you're in the portal, it's designed for mobile where it feels like more of a web app. And I think that is something that we've talked about internally, especially as we see more and more brands doing what we, quite frankly, previously did.
Yes.
And a lot of brands want that.
Yeah.
To be direct, because like they're like, oh, it's just so easy to reply. And what I'm curious on is there actually any sort of, I don't know if anyone's actually done a test, like a statistical difference between replying versus clicking a link and being able to have like a more richer experience with the brand. I don't know. Like, what's your sort of feel on that? Do you have opinions?
Yeah. I mean, I think that to your point, right, if I have to like multi-step or text message back a robot in order to do the thing that I want to do, that's somewhat inconvenient, right? Like having a clear interface that lets me quickly just do whatever the thing is that I want to do. I think that that's, as a consumer, that's what I want, right? Like I want to be able to just, if I want to pause the stinking order or like skip it or cancel or whatever the thing is, I just want this stupid option to like do the thing quickly. So I don't have to, like having to log in, like that's basically the cardinal sin, is having to log in to anything. So if I can just one click a deep link and I have the thing open, I think then from the brand's perspective, it's great because it's like, hey, I can incentivize you to do the thing that's like a healthy life cycle thing, right? And as a consumer, I will just take the path of least resistance. So if you text me and say, I can skip the thing or I can cancel the thing or whatever, like I'll just slap whatever the button is to make the thing go away, so I don't have to deal with the problem anymore. But if I can click into a portal, maybe the thing is like, hey, don't lose your benefits of being like a subscriber. Like you can just pause this and start it whenever you want. Like Is it cool if we just remind you in 2 months, right? There's other options there where the consumer can like take the action they want to take and just leave at any time. But if you as like the service provider, product provider, whatever, can offer like deeper like incentives the customer like wouldn't necessarily know exist or have the opportunity to interact with in like a text-based interface, I think that's great. Like, I mean, we've obviously even done testing around that in terms of like, yeah, customers, it turns out if they just know that you can pause it instead of cancel it, they'll just pause the thing because they didn't actually want to cancel because it's super inconvenient then to have to put all your information back in. They just don't know that pausing is an option because subscriptions are a thing that has grown rapidly and people aren't, you know, familiar with all the permutations of it.
And I'd say related to what we were just talking about, not to jump around, but there were a few. And originally, I was like, I'm going to have a rapid fire list of things I'd love for you to talk about. I said one of them, and then we just got into a deep conversation on the first one.
It's going to be 6 podcasts. That's fine. Yeah.
No, it's good. No. But the other thing that I've had conversations with brand operators on is they don't like reminding people that they have an upcoming charge, right? And I think part of a lot of what I've talked about and Joel talked about and we talk about on the podcast is around this idea of consumer centricity. Centricity. Yeah.
Yes. Because here's the thing, right? Like if your business model relies upon like bamboozling the customer out of one extra order, your business is crap. Like you definitely should just do better. Like that is my thing always is like when I overall look at the health of the business, right? Like when we do like our first audit and I'm like trying to wrap my head around like what's the arrangement, it becomes really clear when you have brands where I'm like, you're doomed. Like you're actually not going to make it. And the reason I know you're not going to make it is you've not made something that's like actually like durable and like to the consumer and good. It's not a durable experience. You're just trying to loop people in on like a first order. We'll get them to do a subscription and then they all cancel after like the second one. It is, people will scale their businesses off of models like that. And frankly, like we just like turned down working with people that like, I can see that that's like what they're doing. If they're not like, basically like, hey, we scaled this thing and this is not actually going to work long-term. Can you help us fix it? That I'm totally game for. And it's really fun to run like LTV, like analyses and like histograms on like number of orders and all that fun stuff, because it comes out of the woodwork like instantaneously. Like we have some brands that we work with where they're like, oh yeah, we do, you know, whatever, 1,000 transactions, an AOV of $350. I'm like, wow, okay, cool. Let's dive into this. And I'm like, do you know that you're selling 80% of those orders to like old customers? Like they buy everything that you sell. Like we should try some acquisition strategies now and get some new customers. But like that kind of like brand loyalty stuff gets me really excited because I was like, you're actually doing like a net good. Like this just isn't like a thing that you dupe somebody into buying. Like people are actually finding like a joyful experience in this. And I think that if your business isn't trying to revolve around that, then it's just a cash grab and that's kind of dumb.
So what are things that you have seen and would love to see more of for brands to be more consumer centric, right? So I think communication ahead of a subscription renewal is like one obvious example, right? I think an obvious way to make that into not just a scary thing where maybe the person is canceling is the ability to have like, well, and they have like upsells in there or the ability for them to swap what they're getting. So it's not just a reminder. It's a reminder where some people will cancel because of the reminder, but at least it's a good consumer experience. But you also have a segment of customers who will use that to accept an upsell or will, you know, swap to another product.
I think that when you can use that notification as an invitation to take the customer deeper into the offering, whether that's like some variation of the product they're already subscribed to or a new product that exists or something along those lines, I think that all of that is really healthy. That's the way to win the game, right? So like example here on company that we work with that does the body wash, shampoo, conditioner, all of that fun stuff. They just came up with like a bar soap and a deodorant product in like the last year, which are great. And the customers really like them. And the really fun thing was,
yeah, I'm a customer.
Yeah. And it smells great. I feel so manly. So when you, they did a really great job and we did some fun tests around taking customers and giving them the opportunity to try new products essentially. And just, we want to own their shower, right? We want to take all of the categories in the bathroom and just slowly spread into all of those in like a really positive way, which is, again, to use the like dogs eating the Thanksgiving dinner analogy, just because you also sell other products does not mean your customers know that you sell those other products. You may even send them promotional emails about those products and they still have no idea, but there's something around where I always like aligning the positive action or like the value prop or the question or whatever with the action, right? So like some of the most successful subscription tests that we've ever run are taking things like putting the frequency of the delivery next to the phrase auto delivery, right? Versus like one time, or taking the arrangement of you actually save this percentage on every order and putting it next to the price differential. So it's just moving all the content around so where it's like as close to the where the decision's happening as possible. Same thing with like an upsell or telling somebody about a new product or getting them to try like a different variant or something like that. If you attach it to, you have an order shipping in 3 days, would you like to try any of this other stuff or mix it up and swap out a product or something like that? By tying that discovery as close to the next like action or decision that needs to happen, that's where you see the most success because it's easy for them to connect the dots in those things. If you're expecting, I sent out this email a month ago about the fact that we have deodorant and they have a new order coming, they're definitely going to go modify their order. No, they're not. No one's going to do that. You got to connect the things as close as possible. So I get really excited about that kind of stuff as well.
And I'm curious, like, so going back to like the tools that for you as, we'll call you in this case an operator, but, you know, a growth marketer or however you want to label yourself.
I'm enjoying the fact that you're finding difficulty finding the right words. Go on.
I'll just call you magician. Oh, that magician. You know, what are the, so what have been some of the limitations historically that have made it difficult for you to run experiments?
Yeah.
And that's assuming that you've found it difficult to run experiments.
Yeah.
And then what are some of the experiments and stuff that you're able to run now that, and like you were talking earlier on, like, I mean, we were talking about Recharge, but like challenges with Recharge around analytics. Right. So, and full disclosure, I mean, you and I work together on at least one brand. So I'm not trying to just toot our horn, but I am curious around like, what are the sort of differences that you found in using?
I hated Recharge a long time ago. Don't worry. Yeah.
Like, what are some of the differences you've seen with the different platforms that people should be aware of as an operator brand? Because I know one thing we've talked about before is like page load speed. You know, what are the different libraries that are being loaded? Like, what are the different things or even like elements of flexibility? I think part of the challenge we've seen is that sometimes you brands want the WYSIWYG editor where you just fill in the blanks. On the other hand, part of what you and I have done together is we're like, here's a canvas, just change everything in the DOM, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's two very different spectrums.
No, totally. I think that's the thing is having a segregated checkout for subscription orders is just, it's been historically terrible, right? Like that has been, to use Recharge as the obvious example, they just drop orders on the floor all the time, analytics wise. And it doesn't matter what you do in terms of getting, you know, solid Google Analytics, like tracking and events and all of that fun stuff. You're just missing part of the story, which sucks from like an optimization standpoint. And there's different tricks and things like that that we've done, try to like piece that story back together on the other side, which comes out the other end of the pipe. But that has been historically very frustrating. And so to be able to now pass all customers through a Shopify checkout is enormous. It also gives us the opportunity to do some really cool stuff that recently started diving into, which is giving somebody the option to switch their one-time order to a subscription, actually like on their way out the door through the checkout, where you're like, hey, this order is going to cost this many dollars. Did you know that you get free shipping if you switch to subscription, right? Again, you're putting the decision or like the final action as close to the actual like decision or action that is happening, right? The other one that's concurrent with it, where they are looking at the price of the shipping and you're telling them that you can make it go away and you will send them a text message 3 days before the order, right? Like that's very successful. And so that's only possible because we're on a unified checkout now. And so especially as people grow, we move to Shopify Plus and all of that fun stuff, gives us a lot of levers to pull in the checkout. And specifically around subscription, you can do a lot of de-risking of stuff there where it's like, man, you are like the most brass tacks moment on the checkout. So, and that's a very good thing to optimize because you can also like hey, you know what would go great with your checkout? Some paralysis. And then people just don't check out, which is like a disaster. So that's why we test it. But it's also a fun time too, to one of the things that you can do unintentionally is disincentivize customers from subscription through things like shipping costs or stuff like that. And so by giving them like a discount that drops them below the free shipping threshold, that's a funny one. And so there's other things that you can do there in terms of like inviting them to, you know, hey, get twice as much, half as often, that kind of stuff that you can do in the checkout, I think is quite helpful. And then beyond that, everybody always forgets about it, but like the account management portal is like actually where subscription happens. The purchase is happening on the website. But as you pointed out, like that doesn't make you a customer or even a subscriber. That makes you a purchaser. The subscription happens in the account portal. And so for us, having the flexibility to be able to go in and say like, hey, we're going to use the API to like do this switcheroo of this item or make this month's featured add-on or whatever the thing is really powerful for us on a testing side of things. The one thing that I will say though, which you briefly alluded to, is as you are evaluating tools to use for subscription, finding out how they run and like how they collect analytics across the site is really important, because you can very quickly find yourself in a situation where you've got render blocking code running on your product pages and it's just like, it's hurting you by a couple tenths of a second on page load speed, which is just enough to make Google hate you a tiny bit more, which is just enough to make your organic search go down and that kind of stuff. So for us, like that's always the balance is, yes, we love data. I like data when it's happening like server side as much as possible. And yes, doing it on the client side is fine, but render blocking code for the sake of the platform being a data aggregator is not my favorite thing.
And how would someone be able to check to see if that's happening?
What a great question. Just run Google's Lighthouse thing in Chrome, and it'll tell you all your offenders for render blocking stuff, and they'll have their name attached to it. You can see it.
Okay. I guess put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. So it's stuff like rebuy for like upsells and things like that. Like people that have rebuy carts, man, that's just such a bad one. It just breaks everything on the website, and it's super slow. But they love just like, I refer to they just lick the page. Like they just put their trackers on like literally everything, and it slows everything down and it's awful and gummy. So like one of the things that we'll do like mid stage working with somebody is after we get over like the ROI hump is we'll just invest in like, hey, your upsell like probably just needs to be like one or two items. Like you don't need like the complex logic tree. Like in fact, testing upsells with rebuy, I've like never found that like the hyper complex like logic tree thing ever wins compared to just giving one or two options that stay the same all the time based on the size of stuff in their cart. That's it. Like if you imagine it was free shipping threshold, then fine. But you can save a lot of dead weight by looking to replace some of that stuff. Now we're getting off a whole other.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, man, I wish we weren't going to Europe because we could have like a weekly series on cool stuff.
I'll do one in Europe.
We have the Eiffel Tower in the back. Although I don't know if you're actually, you didn't list Paris under your list of places, I don't think, but.
We're going to Avignon. We're going to be in like the south of France. But we'll be in Paris for like a week, so I can cleverly position myself in front of the Eiffel Tower.
No, man, because I actually think that'd be really dope for us to do a deep dive on a bunch of stuff, because I think, like, at least a few other things that come to mind, and, you know, we try to keep these episodes pretty short, both out of respect for your time as well as for listeners, but, like, you know, I think there's just so much for you and I to talk around, just even, like, you know, like, let's talk about basically win-back flows, right? So everyone's used to the basically where it's like you click a reason, then you basically can create an offer based off of whatever reason they chose. I think one thing I'm curious on too is asking someone to choose to pause for a specific amount of time versus just being able to pause. And then instead what you do is you like follow up with them like effectively through remarketing through email once they've paused. Like, have you done tests or experiments around like making someone have to decide how long they want to pause, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks? Because my assumption is that most people when they're at that place are basically like, you make me think I'll just skip the order or I'll cancel. I could be wrong.
It's always fun because like once you get really far down the rabbit hole into like account portal stuff, like your sample size shrinks drastically, right? Because
yeah,
oftentimes you don't want people coming. If lots of people are coming to your account portal, like you probably got problems. It's like a necessary place that you want optimized, but you don't want lots and lots of people in there unless they're taking up sales or something. So, but specifically around like pause, cancel. Yeah, I think you don't want to give somebody like a shocking number of options. Like in general, I find exactly what your point is like, look, I don't know. Like, I guess I'll just like cancel it, the darn thing, and then start it over again. You also don't want to give too few options that just don't make any sense, right? So that's the thing is like, your options for pausing are 1 day, 1 month, 1 year. And you're like, oh my gosh, could you just... I think that letting people specify is fine. At the point that somebody is pausing, unless your product is like enormous and gets used over like a quarter, pausing longer than like a month is basically just a cancel. It's just like a super soft cancel. So I think it's, you know, I always think Drought's like a great example, right? Like coffee is like a consumable product that stays good for on the order of weeks, not months. And so, oh shoot, I'm not done with this thing, I'll just kick it back a week. Like, I think a week is probably like a reasonable amount of time, or a couple of weeks because you're going to be traveling or things, right? So if you just work backwards as like thinking about the consumer, like what are the common reasons that people don't do the thing, right? Which is, I'm going to be traveling, or I have too much of the thing. Otherwise they're ordering more. So figuring out how to accommodate both of those scenarios, I think, is like the important thing. But yeah, like just infinite options is terrible. Like, I don't know, make it a damn drop down or something. But like too few options that just like kind of miss the point also just gets people to hard cancel for sure.
Right. It's like if you don't give someone an answer that feels right, they don't want to pick something that doesn't actually...
Yeah. You just guessed how long I'm going to be traveling for. Boy, I hope you didn't get it wrong or I'm canceling, right?
Although it's funny, like I was signing up for a website today that they wouldn't let me finish my registration for a free event. I think it was for a DTX day or something. And they wanted to know how I was referred to them. And I'm like, you emailed me, like, but I have like this drop down of like referred by the internet, referred by, I'm like, I'm literally scrolling down trying to find the thing. I'm like, nope, not, it wasn't word of mouth. Nope. Or no, it wasn't an internet banner. Like, I literally was spending time going through the options and I caught myself and I'm like, this is for a free event. Right? No, but like when I think through, like, again, like the cognitive, like, what's that great book? Like, Don't Make Me Think. That's one, like, that's among like the great, like, originally user experience product design books of like eliminating decision making, make it super easy. And yeah, but don't give so few of things where if the two options are like so different, like, well, neither one of these makes sense.
Nope. Nobody needs to cancel in less than a week, because otherwise they'll just get the damn thing and they'll just wait a couple of days. Like, that's ridiculous, right? So, or if you have to cancel longer than like a month, like, I don't know, you got something going on, or you're just never coming back, right?
I mean, you're traveling for the next few months.
Yeah. So you know what I did? I told my assistant, go cancel all my subscriptions and just start them back up again when I get back, because 3 months, like, I'm not going to pause a subscription for 3 months. Like, that's ridiculous, right? Like, it's like, oh, just, yeah, you just cancel them and then come back, right? So for me, it's like, yeah, give them like 1 through 4 weeks to like pause it. Otherwise it's just, it's a skip or a cancel at that point, right?
How does your assistant know all your subscriptions? Like, how do you keep track of them if they're sent? Is it just assuming that they all send you upcoming order reminders?
Should we do a whole podcast on how to get leverage out of an assistant? Because I've written tomes on this topic.
Yeah, 10x leverage.
That's it. That's literally it. There's no short answer is that in order to be effective with an assistant, they have to basically know every single detail of your life, which is it's a big trust thing. John and I are like this.
Yeah. Awesome, man. I know we didn't get nearly through everything. We didn't even talk about headless.
No, we didn't. And I could do a whole podcast on that. I'm telling you, that's fine. Well, as long as I'm allowed to drink wine on the podcast, I think we're fine to do it in Europe. Yeah.
Let's say like a short sort of, because part of what you and I were talking about, especially with the brands you're going, like going from 2 to 20 and then beyond, is there's a lot of appeal into headless. And obviously headless works in some circumstances. You know, it's a nascent industry. I think one of the biggest conversations I've had brands who are thinking of going headless is, you know, if you're investing in engineering on your team, like, it depends on why you're going to go headless. So let's forget my opinion for now. I'm curious what yours is, because you have a very strong one. it seems.
So this is the thing, is I've never worked with a brand that's gone headless that we haven't spent more than half of our time basically trying to recreate things that exist on just like using the damn platform to begin with. And it is just a giant exercise in engineering. And it's sort of like, hey, we adopted this platform for e-commerce for all these benefits, and then we threw away all the benefits and went headless so that we could totally engineer them and recreate the wheel ourselves. And I think to get to parity now, frankly, I think the pandemic and then Shopify, you know, dumping gazillions of dollars into making Shopify 2.0 structure be a thing, is now made. Like, I used to have like a tier where I was like, oh, if you're like at like 2 million, you could start to consider headless. And I was like, that's more like 5. That's more like 10. Now I'm like, it's like $50 million. Like, unless you have like the world's most complicated distribution and you're like doing brick and mortar as like 80% of your business or something like that. Like, I have migrated more people to headless than I have seen more people leave like a platform to go headless now. It's like they do the cycle where you just like...
Oh, you're saying you migrate more people back from headless? Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah.
I think you might have said the reverse. Yeah.
This is the thing, is that it's like, if you want to go burn like 150K and pay a whole bunch of engineers like a whole bunch of money to basically rebuild a crappy version of Shopify, like headless is exact. It's like a fine way to burn all that money. But I can't think of a great reason other than complicated like distribution or like drop shipping logic or whatever that could necessitate headless. Because I mean, we have also done, one of my favorite things to do as a service provider is to work with companies that engage expensive design agencies to like redesign their website and then test those designs in. And they do not make you more money. They make their portfolio look fantastic. And like, people might tell you that your website looks great, but I have yet to find like the picture being prettier is the thing that makes your business make more sense, right? It's like, those are aesthetics, and you maybe have more control over that in headless. Like, you actually don't, but let's pretend you do for a second. That there's no amount of scale in the stratosphere, I think, that starts to make any sense at all, because you're throwing out all the benefits of the platform. Now you're responsible for integrating literally everything yourself. All your analytics are going to be non-standard. You're walking a path of now also trying to keep up with feature releases of all the other things that have all these investment dollars dumped into it. It's just, it's a hard road.
I mean, I would say, like, just to give a counter argument, I mean, I'd say that the predominant reasons I've heard for headless, first of which you kind of already hit on, which is you can make make the site experience feel more unique to the brand and give the brand more control over the experience. Now, whether or not, to what extent that, I mean, obviously there's brand differentiation that matters, and then we can separate that.
Actually makes money, yes.
And every site looking like a Shopify site isn't necessarily, you know, the best thing. What I will say, though, is...
I'll counter that. Go on.
Okay, or maybe it's predictable, so you know where to look, right? I guess that would be the counter argument.
Consumers love understanding how your stupid product page works. When it's like, oh, the cereal floats in front of like the add to cart button just so, I'm like, could you just stop? Like, I really want to just buy the thing. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. Okay. So the next one, though, would be, and Shopify has been notorious of this around, is like basically page load time, right? I think part of that is third party apps, where you're saying like you're installing an app, you don't necessarily realize that it's blocking render or like even first paint, right? Now, so that would be the biggest argument that I've heard is, and you as we'll call it a conversion rate optimization, obsessive compulsive ninja.
Yeah.
You obviously care a lot about that. So
yes.
Is that not enough? Or is that something where you're like, well, maybe, but it would have to be at such a scale of traffic that for you to make the change to warrant the investment in sort of the trade-offs, right?
Yes. And I totally get it, right? Like, there are certain things where you're like, you're looking at page load speed and you're like, wow, this could be faster. And it's like, you're right. How much money do you have to spend to make it faster? And can you avoid all the same like foibles as Shopify, right? And can you do it better than them and keep up with, again, like their development cycle? So if you have hundreds of thousands of dollars to spend on developers to maintain the darn thing and keep it clean and not break anything, and that can totally make sense. You have to be at a very large scale in order for that, again, to make sense. And you have to not fall prey to the exact same things in terms of like integrating all these like third-party things that are going to slow the site down. And another thing that I like to remind people on too is every year your phone gets a little bit faster on the internet and more people go on to phones and pages load faster. One of my favorite ones is we're working with like a luxury clothing client, and they're like, their average like cart size is like $600. And they're like, we're concerned about page load speed. And I was like, do you really think that your customers have slow internet? Like, is that actually like a real concern that you have? Like, I get that if I drive out into like middle America and get on like, I'm sure somewhere's got 3G around here, like your phone. Yeah, it'll take 5 seconds to load. You're absolutely right. All of your customers live in Manhattan and Los Angeles and make over $1.5 million a year. They all have fast internet. You don't actually have to care about that. So that's like another thing that I also try to like bring into the realm of like context, which is like, who's your customer? Do they all just have whatever the newest iPhone is on like 5G? Because there isn't a single website that loads too slow on Shopify, no matter how many damned apps you have like installed on 5G internet on a phone. And that is going to become more true every year. How long is it going to take you to spin up your headless build and then maintain it just to be out Jonesed and then have to like flip back the darn thing back in like 2 years? It's just the amount of time for technological like upgrade just keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And if you're going to go headless, you're now responsible for running that race in addition to running an e-commerce business. It's possible. I wouldn't recommend it.
Are there exceptions to that? So for example, using something like Nacelle with, you know, we'll call it, there's like headless where you basically are using like Vercel and you like launch your own custom site where you connect it. But then there's also this headless ecosystem where, you know, maybe you're using Contentful for the back end, and then you're using Nacelle or Swell or something, right? Like those pre-configured components. Like, do you draw a distinction in those? And do you have experience in that sort of ecosystem? Or are we mostly talking about like what typically people, at least who are currently on Shopify, who are making the move to headless, they're basically building a headless site and then still having to figure out how to use Shopify or something on the back end?
There are definitely permutations of it, right, that are probably better. Again, a thing that always makes me nervous is when I'm now relying on like two or three entities to manage all the different pieces
points of failure.
It. They now all have to, they're all points of failure. They all have to perfectly integrate to one another. One of them comes out with a feature, the other two don't support it. You have to like sit and wait on like a roadmap. That just kind of like complexity that comes out of, I consider them to be a whole podcast on object-oriented versus functional problem solving. I tend to see that stuff like as being like very object-oriented, where it's like, oh, we have like this perfect solution for like the back of it, perfect solution to the front end, right? And then all of the points of intersection are the thing that ends up eating your lunch. And so again, like you're now relying on your company plus all of these other companies to all keep up with the Joneses at the exact like same rate. And you're going to be as fast as the slowest one of all of you.
Got it. Interesting.
I used to just be so optimistic about these things. And then the number of audits that we've done on like headless builds where I'm just like, your analytics don't even work. Like you're double counting half of these pages. You can't use enhanced e-commerce because it only like flows through like the checkout, whatever the thing is. It's just all the standardization type stuff that comes through like a platform. You have to consider all of it because it's all something that you're responsible for maintaining, or these other Lego blocks are responsible for maintaining. Now, like I will say, right, like using like page builder type stuff to do landing pages, like duh, like totally do that, right? Like that kind of stuff is awesome because you can iterate really fast. Because again, like do I think that 0.2 seconds faster on your website is going to make a big of a difference as figuring out what the right value props are to like message to your customer, or what the subscription deal should be, or whatever. Do I think that that's going to win out? No, it's never going to win. It's never going to win out because you are trying to figure out how to run an e-commerce business, not trying to figure out how to like basically redevelop Shopify and maintain it. So you have to decide what business are you in. Are you in, some brands do a terrible job because they're an art project. Some brands do a terrible job because they're an engineering group that technically sells stuff on the internet. But if you really want to make money and you want to do e-commerce right and you want to scale it, like you should probably be focused on that. And yes, all of these other companies are also on the same platform. And so like you're really just like, that's the benchmark. And so I think it's easy to get worked up about that stuff because actually figuring out how to sell stuff to consumers is really hard. And I think that there are a lot of like, I've met a lot of CEOs who in the face of making hard decisions and figuring out how to scale their business would much rather do a website redesign.
Right.
That's the candy. That's the fun part.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a known entity and you have something pretty that looks after it. And I say that as an engineer, where I think that, and even as an entrepreneur, where, you know, we have certain strengths and experiences, and it's hard to do the sort of, it's humbling and it's challenging to do things that you don't really know how to do, especially if you are good at something, or you can point to somebody like, oh, let's build that thing. And then you have that, like, we'll call it that period where you get to believe that thing is going to be the thing that changes it. When in fact, we all know it's generally accumulation of a bunch of small things, right? Or making sure that you're focusing on the right thing that's actually going to push the needle.
Totally. Like the CEO says, hey, we need to scale the company. I really hate the colors like on this page. I'm like, who's your customer? Right? That's like a favorite question. Who's your customer? I don't know. Okay. So do you think that the colors are more important right now, or figuring out who you're selling to is more important right now? And so that's my thing. Like, we get, like, I hate rebuilding websites. We have done lots of them. And the reason I hate them is because they don't ever make money. They just pay off tech. That is like really what building new websites does, is it pays off tech debt. You are not going to like, oh, we're going to increase our conversion rate by 50% by rebuilding. No, it just, I've never seen it happen. And so my thing always is like, someone's like, hey, I want to rebuild my website. Like, do you know who your customer is? Because I refuse to do the thing until you can tell me who your customer is, because I don't know how you're going to scale something when you don't know who you're selling to.
Oh man, that's awesome. All right. Well, so anything, well, besides the fact that we're going to have 10 more follow-up episodes to this conversation going down like different rabbit holes, is there anything else you want to say? One question I like to ask is, do you have a big ask? Like, is there something that anyone on the internet listening to you, like, that you can just put out into the world, that what's something that would like change your life or change your business that you're looking for?
Change my business.
Your business or your life, right? Like, so if it were to happen, like, what would change the game for you?
What an interesting question. I am hesitant. So here's the thing, right? Like, I love working with CEOs. And I would say that my big ask, that doesn't necessarily have to be directed to me, but I think that CEOs being fine with a little ego death and putting down the controller a little bit and being willing to dive in and talk to more of their customers and do the scary thing of finding out who they are, I think would be great. I'd love to meet more people that do that. I'd love to work with more people that do that. One of my favorite pieces of advice is to CEOs is, send out an email from the CEO and offer to let people schedule time to talk with you and give them a gift card or something. I think that's one of the most powerful things you can do as an operator of an e-commerce company, is talk to your damn customers and find out who they are by talking to them, right? Post-purchase surveys are cute. You can get a hell of a lot better sense by just basically walking into a room of people that buy from you and figuring out who they are. And anybody who is willing to do that reasonably uncomfortable and unsexy thing, I'd love to chat about how their experience went and see if there's anything else I can do to help.
That's awesome. That's a good ask. I like how you framed that. All right. Well, you heard that, internet. If you're one of those sexy CEOs who does the uncomfortable things, get in touch with Matthew at Proteus. So yeah, man. Awesome, dude. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. Look forward to having you again soon. If people want to find out more about you and the agency, where should they go? And we'll include a link to your site in the show notes.
Yes. So you notice that our site is very Spartan and just has a list of other brands that we've worked with. That is because we are in the fortunate position of being really good at what we do. And so I do not have a portfolio, and I won't send you one because we don't have one. But I am always willing to talk to good people. And you can only reach out to us by introduction, and you've just got one here from the podcast. So feel free to reach out, or if you know any of the folks that are listed there, I'm sure you can get connected as well.
Awesome to talk this time, and have a great time in Europe. I look forward to seeing you sipping on the Eiffel Tower with your DJ voice.
The next time you see me on the podcast, I'll be wine in hand in Europe.
Yep. Awesome.
All right. Cheers.